The record of federal officers on the frontier in those days showed just how lethal the West still was, even for mounted bluecoats. In 1864, Carson had nearly perished against Comanches and Kiowas at Adobe Walls. Van Dorn and Chivington had had their massacres, but the experience of the ebullient and egocentric Captain William Fetterman in 1866 more closely approximated the real risks of Western command. Oozing self-confidence and itching to kill savages, Fetterman led 80 men out from Fort Phil Kearny in Wyoming on December 21st under orders to rescue a wagon train of woodcutters that was under attack by Red Cloud's Oglala Sioux. He was warned twice that he should do nothing more than escort the woodcutters back to the fort. Instead of following those orders, Fetterman plunged ahead looking for Indians to shoot. He spotted a small and vulnerable-looking group of Sioux warriors and pursued them. He soon discovered that they had been put there as bait. He thus rode directly into ambush. Exactly how many Indians took part in the attack is not known. Enough to kill 80 troopers in less than 20 minutes. In his report to his superiors, Post Commandant Henry Carrington listed some of the items he found on the battlefield the next day. Eyes torn out and laid on rocks. Noses and ears cut off. Teeth chopped out. Brains taken out and placed on rocks. Hands and feet cut off. Private parts severed. The Oglala seemed especially annoyed at two men who carried brand new 16-shot Henry repeating rifles. Presumably, they had done a good deal of damage. Their faces had been reduced to bloody pulp, and one of the men had been pierced by 105 arrows. 2 years later, another Army unit was destroyed at the Battle of the Washita, which was in all other ways a massacre of Indians. In November 1868, Colonel George Custer, commanding the 7th Cavalry for the first time, attacked a Cheyenne village on the Washita River in what is now western Oklahoma. His strategy was the same one that got him killed 8 years later. He divided his force, then advanced over unknown terrain against an enemy of unknown strength, and executed a double envelopment, a maneuver that required overwhelming superiority in numbers. This time he got lucky, at least at first. At dawn, his troopers tore into a small village of 51 lodges under Chief Black Kettle, surprising them and sending them fleeing from their teepees. Black Kettle had made the mistake of not believing his scouts, a mistake Custer also made and would soon pay for. Custer's men rampaged through the snowy camp, killing indiscriminately. Women and children who had taken cover under buffalo robes were dragged out of the teepees by Osage scouts and shot. Though Custer reported that he had killed 103 warriors, he had actually killed only 11. The rest were women, children, and old men. The soldiers then looted and burned the village. Meanwhile, a squad of men under Major Joel Elliott, last seen in hot pursuit of Indians, was now missing. It was later learned that they had fallen for the same immemorial trick that had fooled Fetterman. They had ridden after a bunch of Cheyenne boys. At some distance from the village, the boys evaporated, and in their place appeared several hundred mounted, armed Indians. The white soldiers then dived for cover in the high grass, thus violating a fundamental principle of defensive combat. They abandoned a clear field of fire. They were mostly shot where they lay. Their bodies were later found on the south bank of the river, frozen and horribly mutilated. It was believed that the Indians who killed them were Arapahoes. What were Arapahoes doing near the Cheyenne camp? The answer revealed exactly how lucky Custer had been. Just below Black Kettle's camp, stretching for 15 miles along the river, was the entire winter encampment of the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. Comanches and Kiowas were camped with them. This disconcerting fact was uncovered when a platoon that had gone downriver to round up horses suddenly found itself encircled by warriors from the lower camps. Beyond the Indians, the white men could see hundreds of teepees in the river valley. Laying down a covering fire, they retreated, barely making it back to camp, where they breathlessly told Custer the news. He was alarmed. His men were tired. He was running out of ammunition. The command was alone in sub-zero weather in a hostile wilderness, and his main supply train had been left lightly guarded many miles away. Realizing now that he could not take the 800 captured Indian horses with him, he ordered them all shot. The men used pistols to do it, and the scene was gruesome. After being shot, the horses broke away and ran in all directions, bleeding onto the snow. Then he retreated. He was so worried about an Indian attack that he marched all night. One of the Comanches in those lower camps was 20-year-old Quanah. "When we heard of the fight," he recalled later, "all of our men hurried to the scene, but General Custer retreated when he saw so many of us coming. We did not get close enough to fight him. After several skirmishes without results, we returned to our camp and moved out onto the plains." He never explained how he had come to be there, though the Washita was fully within the Comanche heartland. Custer had only narrowly avoided Fetterman's fate. He had come perilously close to confronting what would have been perhaps the largest group of hostile Indians ever assembled in one place. Later, he would actually face the largest group of hostile Indians ever assembled in one place, and he would not be so lucky. By the time Mackenzie arrived at Fort Concho, in present San Angelo, President Grant's peace policy had been in effect for 2 years. The idea had been to replace graft, corruption, and indifference in the Indian service with a stern but loving kindness. By putting Quakers in place of the old self-serving agents of the Indian office, Indian trust would be regained. Annuities would be paid on time. Promises would be kept. The Indians would honor the Great Father by coming into their reservations, laying down their weapons, and taking up peaceful new lives as farmers, as specified by the Medicine Lodge Treaty. This was devoutly to be wished, especially since nothing like it had ever actually happened. When the Quaker agent Lowry Tatum arrived at the Comanche and Kiowa Agency in 1869, some 2/3 of all Comanches were not on the reservation. They accounted for most of the continuing attacks on settlements in Texas and Mexico. Almost from the start, the plan was a disaster, less a coherent policy than an invitation to open war. Its most basic problem was that the peace policy rewarded aggression and punished good conduct. The Indians realized that their most violent wars always ended with some sort of treaty, which was always accompanied by many splendid gifts and tokens of friendship and trust. They were thus convinced that the easiest way to get money and goods was, in Tatum's words, "to go on the warpath a while, kill a few white people, steal a good many horses and mules, and then make a treaty, and they would get a large amount of presents and a liberal supply of goods for that fall." The treaties also typically allowed them to retain any horses and mules they had stolen. When they behaved well and limited their raiding, on the other hand, they got nothing. They were acutely aware of this. In addition, the Taibos appeared to punish those who were cooperating. In 1868 and 1869, a number of Comanches did come into the reservation, notably from the Yamparica and Noconee bands. But because their West Texas brethren kept raiding, all annuities in 1869 were forfeited to pay depredation claims, thus penalizing the good Indians, which of course made no sense to any of them. Worse still, by prohibiting the use of troops in the reservation areas, the government had created what amounted to a sanctuary for Comanche raiding parties. This was probably the most pernicious effect of the peace policy. It meant there was nothing preventing the Indians from coming and going as they pleased, or from using their 2-million-acre reserve as a base camp for attacks on the Texas settlements. They could evade cavalry pursuit and even keep their stolen stock simply by crossing the Red River. The upshot was that Tatum himself, the pacifist Quaker, became convinced that force would have to be used to get the Comanches to stay on the reservation. It was into this illogical and decidedly unpeaceful world of the far Comanche frontier that Mackenzie came in 1871. The border was still rolling backward, unmaking decades of progress. Counties west of Fort Worth and on down to Waco and the Hill Country continued to empty out. The peace policy was, perforce, about to change, and Ranald Slidell McKenzie would be the instrument of that change. Following the Salt Creek Massacre, where General Sherman had narrowly escaped, and the trial of the Kiowa chiefs who had led it, McKenzie wrote a letter to Sherman advocating a large-scale campaign. "The Kiowas and Comanches are entirely beyond any control and have been for a long time," he wrote. "Mr. Tatum understands the matter. He is anxious that the Kiowas and Comanches, now out of control, be brought under. This can only be accomplished by the Army. It is not very important who we deal with first, the Staked Plains people or those of the Reserve." Sherman agreed, not only to a campaign, but to a new freedom for the Army to pursue hostile Indians north of the border. Nothing had changed officially, but this was the beginning of the end of the peace policy. And so, in the fall of that year, McKenzie, not quite knowing what he was doing yet, and with an indifferent regiment he had not yet had time to remake, marched 600 men and 25 Tonkawa scouts up into Blanco Canyon and made his humbling mistakes, and then had 66 of his horses, including his own gray pacer, deftly removed from him by Quanah and his midnight raiders. That encounter is worth noting because such Indian behavior was probably without precedent on the plains. Indians habitually avoided soldiers. Almost all their battles with Army regulars were defensive, including those against Fetterman in Wyoming and Custer on the Washita. Large concentrations of soldiers with long supply trains were a signal to simply disappear, which was usually easy enough. It was the reason so many U.S. troops spent so much time marching and riding about, looking for and not finding Indians. Not finding Indians had been the principal activity of the U.S. cavalry for years in the West. McKenzie's force was enormous by Plains standards. It was the largest that had ever been sent to pursue Indians. And yet it was directly into the camp of this large assemblage of firepower, the men all were equipped with Colt revolvers and repeating Spencer carbines and several hundred rounds each, that Quanah rode on the night of October 10th. He and his men had not simply run off horses on a far perimeter, they had crashed directly into the sleeping area, nearly running over McKenzie's tent, all the while screaming and shooting and ringing cowbells. Was it the sheer reckless bravery of the young that had led him to do it? Was it desperation? An instinctive defensive response to the presence of so many bluecoats so far out on the Buffalo Plains, like a man blocking a punch? In later interviews, Quanah said his plan had been to put the soldiers afoot. If he had succeeded, the result might well have been a disaster of epic proportions for the whites. They had avoided that disaster by moving quickly in the darkness, amid the panicked horses and the lethal swinging pickets, to recapture most of their mounts. But there were now 66 dismounted cavalrymen on the high remote plains of West Texas. And there was not much you could do with such men under those circumstances, except order them to march east, back to the supply camp. Demoralized and humiliated by the repeated blunders his command had made, the man they called Three-Fingered Jack and his 4th Cavalry sorted through the tangled mass of horses, lariats, and picket pins and set out at dawn on the morning of October 11th to find the Comanches who had attacked them. McKenzie had no idea then that he had stumbled into not just a Quahati village, but the main body of the Quahati band, several hundred lodges worth. Though the principal chiefs of the Quahatis were thought to be Bull Bear and Wild Horse, the village was under the much younger Quanah's command. The remarkable tactics employed during this extended engagement were his and his alone. Meanwhile, McKenzie, snapping the stumps of his fingers irritably, it had already become a defining personal habit, was also completely unaware that he was about to embark upon a rollicking 40-mile chase along a razor edge of the Llano Estacado, the likes of which no Western troops had ever experienced. The day began with yet another blunder by the white soldiers, this one far more serious. Just as the first light began to streak the eastern sky, two detachments of troops searching in the valley for the lost herd came upon a dozen Comanches leading as many horses. Thrilled with their good luck, the men under Captain E.M. Heil spurred forward, gaining rapidly on the Indians until they were just within pistol range. The Indians abandoned the animals and appeared to make a run for it, crossing a ravine and climbing onto the higher ground just beyond it, where a butte rose toward the top of the canyon walls. The soldiers, who also numbered a dozen and were now 3 miles from their camp, followed. As they ascended toward the butte, they could see in the clear light of morning that the Indians they were following had turned on them. And now a much larger force had emerged on the high ground. Heil had been succored by the same trick that had fooled Fetterman and Elliot. Suddenly, the prairie was fairly swarming with Indians, all mounted and galloping toward us with whoops and blood-curdling yells that, for the moment, seemed to take the breath completely away from our bodies, wrote Carter. It was like an electric shock. All seemed to realize the deadly peril of the situation. Above them, from the battlements of the canyon walls, came the eerie, high-pitched ululation of the Comanche women, looking down at their men and cheering them on. Again, it was the 23-year-old Quanah riding in front, resplendent in black war paint and bear claw necklace, and armed with a brace of six-shooters. Carter found him terrifying to look at, and considering Quanah's height and massive upper body muscles, there is no reason to doubt him. Having sprung the trap, Quanah ordered his warriors to flank and surround the 12 men. The besieged troopers, realizing what was about to happen to them, dismounted and backed slowly toward the ravine, firing as they retreated. Suddenly, the 7 men with Heil turned and ran, abandoning their comrades to the Indians. The Indians whooped and came on. The 5 remaining soldiers, one of whom had been shot in the hand, continued their retreat. As they reached the lip of the ravine, they unlocked their magazines and delivered several volleys, driving the Indians back long enough for them to mount their horses. But as they turned and started toward the ravine, the horse-carrying Private Seander Gregg faltered. Carter gives us an interesting and rare snapshot of frontier battle in the close-quarters fight that followed. Seeing Gregg's problem, Quanah spun and rode quickly toward him, zigzagging his horse and turning Gregg and his stumbling mount into a shield. Quanah's command of his horse was such that Carter and the others could not shoot at him without hitting Gregg. As Quanah closed for the kill, Gregg tried to use his carbine, but in his panic failed to pull the lever hard enough, jamming the cartridge. Carter shouted at him to use his six-shooter, but it was too late. Quanah was upon him. He shot Gregg in the head from feet or inches away. It would have been customary for Quanah to scalp the fallen Gregg, but instead he whirled and with the rest of his men galloped away and up the canyon wall. Amazed, Carter turned and saw why. The Tonkawa scouts had crested the ridge. Behind them rose the prodigious dust from Mackenzie's main column. Carter's cool head had saved his men from almost certain death. For his actions in Blanco Canyon that morning, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was undoubtedly a very brave man. But he had something else going for him, too, that would bear importantly on the final outcome of the Indian Wars: Spencer rifles. Prior to the Civil War, the only repeating weapons in military use in America were the six-shot revolvers that Samuel Colt had introduced in the 1840s. But the war had seen the advent of the repeating rifle, most of which were Spencer carbines. For their time, they were technological wonders. They fired 52-caliber bullets from a 7-round magazine, which could be reloaded in 1/10 the time it took to reload a Colt-style revolver, and gave the rifles a sustainable rate of fire of 20 rounds per minute. They were accurate up to 500 yards. The Comanches had nothing at the time of the Blanco Canyon fight to match it. Their main weapons, revolvers and bows, were effective only at short range, generally less than 60 yards. The single-shot muskets they carried, meanwhile, were accurate at longer ranges but were so cumbersome to load, 2 shots a minute from horseback would have been considered good, that they were mainly only used to fire an opening volley. Carter noted that most of their muskets were muzzle-loading. The mismatch was extraordinary. Colonel Richard Dodge observed this huge gap in firepower between whites and Indians. He believed that a horse Indian armed with repeating rifle, an arm suited to his mode of fighting, was the finest natural soldier in the world. But Indians carrying repeaters would not appear in numbers until the last days of the Plains Wars. And even at Little Bighorn, 5 years later, most of the shots the Indians fired came from bows. Now that Mackenzie's column had nearly caught up to Quanah's advance guard, the chase began in earnest. Mackenzie outnumbered him, and with his superior weaponry enjoyed an enormous tactical advantage, something the Indians, who scrupulously avoided pitched battles against well-equipped bluecoats, were well aware of. They were also defending their village, which included their women and children. And so they ran. One might think that an entire human settlement, consisting of perhaps several hundred lodges, with large numbers of women and children and old men, many tons of equipment and provisions and supplies, along with a remuda of 3,000 horses and mules, an unspecified number of cattle and dogs, would be an easy enough quarry. The Comanche village could not hide on the open plains, nor could it possibly move as fast as a well-mounted and determined force of nearly 600 men. These things seem obvious enough. This was one of the few times in recorded history where a large number of troops pursued an entire village in open country, and its outcome might have seemed a foregone conclusion. Instead, Quanah gave Colonel Mackenzie an object lesson in one of the most important components of Plains warfare down the centuries: escape. Aware now that they were hunting the whole camp as well as the warriors, Mackenzie's men moved northwest along the Clear Fork of the Brazos, cutting a gentle arc just to the east of the present city of Lubbock. The river ran through a canyon that was sometimes narrow and sometimes opened out into broad valleys broken by ravines and rolling sandhills, and bordered by high, often impassable bluffs. The men saw small herds of buffalo here and there, and at places where the creek widened into lovely, clear pools, enormous flocks of ducks and curlews. This was unmapped terrain, pristine and untouched by white civilization. Every so often they would pass abandoned grass and brush huts, known as wickiups, that were used by the Indian herders. The highest of the bluffs, on the west side of the canyon, were part of a massive geological formation in West Texas called the Caprock, essentially a long seam of rock that underlies the Llano Estacado and becomes an outcropping just at the point where the high plains give way to the lower rolling plains. The formation is worth noting because it became a key part of the Indians' evasive maneuvers. Seen from the land below, where Mackenzie's men were, it looks like an enormous shelf, topped by rocky battlements. It rises anywhere from 200 to 1,000 feet above the lower plains. The term Llano Estacado is usually translated as staked plain, but that is not what Coronado meant when he named it. He meant palisaded plain, meaning a plain that begins or ends in a steep cliff. The Caprock runs for several hundred miles. The men marched steadily through the day in the stillness and utter solitude of this lovely valley, only disturbed by the tramp of our horses' hoofs. They were more than 50 miles from their supply camp, isolated on the absolute edge of the known world, in one of the most dangerous places on the plains for white men. Late in the afternoon, they came upon the site of Quanah's village. The Comanches had left in great haste, dragging their enormous load with them, leaving a broad trail up the canyon. Confident now that they were close on the heels of the slow-moving tribe, Mackenzie's column spurred forward, following their 25 Tonkawa trackers. That confidence was short-lived. Soon the trail divided, and then it appeared to cross and recross itself in every direction until the scouts could discern no clear direction. After much parleying with Mackenzie and the other officers, the scouts concluded that Quanah and his band had actually doubled back on their pursuers and had proceeded away back down the trail. Frustrated and chagrined that they had been outfoxed yet again by the Comanches, the 4th had no choice but to countermarch, bivouacking for the night at the site of the abandoned village. The next morning, the Tonks managed to pick up the trail again, but now the broad traces left by hundreds of lodge poles and thousands of head of stock seemed to do the impossible, climbing hundreds of feet up the nearly vertical canyon wall and over the cliffs of the Caprock. Somehow, the village was behaving like a small group of riders. And now the soldiers toiled upward through an extremely steep ascent over rock outcroppings and ravines. At the top, they saw something that relatively few white men had ever seen, the preternaturally flat expanse of the high plains, covered only with short buffalo grass. "As far as the eye could reach," wrote Carter, "not an object of any kind or a living thing was in sight. It stretched out before us, one uninterrupted plain, only to be compared with the ocean in its vastness." The scene was terrifying, even for men with experience of the plains. "This is a terrible country," railroad worker Arthur Ferguson had written a few years earlier, "the stillness, wildness, and desolation of which is awful. Not a tree to be seen. The stillness, too, was perfectly awful. Not a sign of man to be seen, and it seemed as if the solitude had been eternal." The men noticed something else, too. The temperature was dropping. A norther was starting to kick up. They were at an elevation over 3,000 feet, still wearing their summer uniforms. The day before, they had basked in the warm sunshine of the cloistered canyon. Now, the north wind bit into them, and the short, stiff grass made the task of tracking the Comanches difficult at best. Again, the column paused while the Tonks tried to figure out where Quanah's village had gone. When they finally found the trail, they realized that, after following the edge of the Caprock, it went back over the bluff and down into the canyon. Disgusted, and aware that they had been duped once more, the troopers made the dangerous descent, only to find the same confused lot of wildly crisscrossing trails, some leading up the valley, some down, and some moving directly across it. The Tonks fanned out again. Now they found that the trail led once again up and over the steep bluffs, this time on the other side of the canyon. Again, the troopers went up through the rocky breaks. For all of their anger and frustration, the men were beginning to feel admiration, bordering on astonishment, at what Quanah's Comanches were able to do. Wrote Carter, "It was a singularly sharp trick, even for Indians, done of course to blind us and gain time in moving their families of women and children as far as possible out of our reach. Without our own Indian scouts to beat the Comanches at their own native shrewdness, we would have undoubtedly lost the trail and in hopelessness abandoned the task." Whether the Tonks were beating the Comanches or being successfully tricked time and time again by a commander who knew exactly what he was doing is a matter of interpretation. Back upon the Llano Estacado yet again, the troops began to feel the full fury of the norther. Under a darkening sky, the frigid wind cut through their thin uniforms. Many of the men had neither coats nor gloves, and they were now 100 miles from their supply base. As they moved forward, they caught occasional glimpses of the fleeing band, silhouetted against the horizon. They were closer than they had thought, and as if to underscore that fact, Comanche riders suddenly appeared on their flanks, trying to divert them. Mackenzie refused to be distracted. He pressed his column onward toward the village, which in its haste and alarm had begun to throw off all sorts of debris, including lodge poles and tools. Even puppies, which some of Mackenzie's men picked up and placed athwart their saddles. Battle seemed imminent. The Tonks painted themselves and invoked their medicine. The men closed up in columns of fours. The pack mules were closed in and set in herd formation. Now, as if on cue, the leaden skies seemed to descend upon them. What had been a garden variety norther now turned into what people in West Texas call a blue norther. Rain, sleet, and snow all mixed together, driven relentlessly by winds up to 50 miles per hour. Darkness was coming on fast, and the moment for decision had arrived. The 4th Cavalry could either gallop forward into the gathering storm and attack, or break off for the day. Oddly, considering how aggressive Mackenzie was by nature, he decided not to attack. He did this against the advice of his officers. In retrospect, he probably made the right decision. His men were fatigued, his horses worn thin and frail, and unlike the Comanches, he had no fresh mounts. The soldiers dismounted, and the storm that had been building up all afternoon now unleashed its full fury. Winds of gale force drove freezing rain, which soon coated the men with ice. It was the sort of night in which a soldier and his horse could easily die. Huge hailstones began to fall, bruising the troopers. They wrapped themselves in what they could find and settled miserably in. Mackenzie himself had brought no overcoat with him. Somebody was kind enough to wrap him in a buffalo robe. The Quahadis, meanwhile, did not stop. They soldiered on into the tooth of the norther for the rest of the night. One can only wonder what it must have been like. The next day, Mackenzie made a half-hearted attempt to follow them, but soon gave up. He had chased them more than 40 miles from present-day Crosbyton to Plainview. He was beginning to push the limits of his supplies. The next day, while the troopers were making their descent back into Blanco Canyon, they cornered two stray Comanches in a ravine. For some reason, perhaps out of frustration, Mackenzie insisted on directing the skirmish from the front. He was hit by a barbed arrow that pierced to the bone and had to be cut out. Embarrassed at his own impetuousness, he never mentioned in his official report that he had been wounded. Robert Carter summed up the disappointment he felt in the campaign's end in his memoirs, saying that it was with the keenest regret and bitter disappointment that the driving of this half-breed Quahada into the Fort Sill Reservation to become later a good Indian could not have been accomplished then by the 4th Cavalry, instead of its being delayed until more than 3 years from that date, and then by converging columns operating in four directions. Quanah roamed free, and Mackenzie had missed a glorious opportunity to break the most violent Comanche band in its homeland. 17. Mackenzie Unbound. For the Free Comanches in the spring of 1872, Mackenzie's dramatic failure at Blanco Canyon was both good news and bad news. The good news was that one of America's toughest combat officers had been duped and humiliated time and time again by people who knew a great deal more about this sort of warfare than he did. Quanah had outmaneuvered and outnavigated him. Mackenzie's men had stumbled around in darkness and in dead-end arroyos and had their horses stampeded and paid a terrible price. They had been led on a merry chase, not by a highly mobile war party, but by an entire village. The Bluecoats had nearly perished in a storm that, nevertheless, did not prevent the Indians, young and old, from traveling to safety. Considering that the Taibos had almost lost all their horses and their supply train, they were probably lucky to be alive. The bad news, for those who could see it, was that Blanco Canyon marked the beginning of the end of the old empire. The logic was disarmingly simple. Previous military expeditions had violated Comancheria's borders and had introduced the Indians to the idea that their home ranges were no longer completely safe. But they had done nothing to change the basic balance of power. Now, in their deliberate penetration of the heartland, the Bluecoat leaders were signaling their intent not just to protect the frontier, but to destroy the raiders themselves, to find the wolves in their den and kill them. They were aiming directly at the source of Comanche strength, and much of that strength was pure illusion, a sort of fantasy propped up by the self-defeating politics of Washington, D.C. In the year 1872, the once glorious Comanches were really nothing more than a tiny population of overmatched and outgunned aboriginals who happened to occupy an absurdly large chunk of the nation's midsection. That they were able to do so in an era of steam engines, transcontinental railroads, nation-spanning telegraph lines, and armies capable of greater destruction than the world had ever witnessed was nearly inconceivable. Now, finally, that was going to change. Blanco Canyon meant that the tribe's final ruin was only a matter of time, a few years at most, perhaps months. It meant that there existed both the will to pursue them to the Caprock and beyond, embodied in grim warriors like Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan, the men who had destroyed the South, and a commander in Texas who was capable of doing it. The dour, irascible Mackenzie was nothing if not a quick study, and he had just learned a critical lesson in how not to fight Comanches in the Texas Panhandle. For the moment, however, death came to the frontier, as it always had. In the spring of 1872, Comanche and Kiowa raiders swooped down into Texas settlements as though there were nothing in the world that could possibly stop them. Some of those attacks were made by reservation Comanches, Yamparicas, Nokonis, and Panaticas, who used their agency as a refuge. Some were made by the Quahadis, who had never come to the reservation. Others were accounted for by Shaking Hands Kotsotika Band, which was straddling both worlds. The latter had come into the agency over the winter to get food and annuity goods, and then had moved back out onto the Buffalo Plains in the spring. Others, from the reservation bands, had followed them. The situation was highly fluid, unsettled, explosive. Many residents of the frontier, especially those in the Palo Pinto country southwest of Fort Worth, thought that 1872 was the worst year ever for Indian raids. A district judge from that area wrote a letter to President Grant that year, begging for relief. He described the worsening horror and said that, "I might give Your Excellency scores of instances of recent date of murder, rape, and robbery which the Indians have committed alone in the counties composing my judicial district. It was but a few days since the whole Lee family, three of them being females, were ravished, murdered, and most terribly mutilated. Then Mr. Dobbs, Justice of the Peace of Palo Pinto County, was but last week murdered and scalped. His ears and his nose were cut off. William McCluskey was but yesterday shot down by those same bloody Quaker Pets upon his own threshold." Such a description of frontier violence could as easily have come from 1850 as from 1872. News of depredations had become so drearily familiar that it could sometimes seem unreal, almost a cliché. It was all horrifyingly real, of course. The terror had been taking place along roughly the same line of longitude in Texas for more than 35 years. Like some nightmarish and never-ending war,